In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a man who, for perhaps the last decade or so, give or take a year, has been a key figure in the politics of Israel, Natan Sharansky. He has held a number of posts in the Israeli government. He served as Minister of Industry and Trade, as Minister of the Interior, as Minister of Housing and Construction, and also Deputy Prime Minister. Before coming to Israel, he was well known for his political work in the Soviet Union. He was born in the Ukraine. He's a graduate in mathematics from the Physical Technical Institute in Moscow, and was for a number of years, at least a decade, involved in the human rights movement in Russia, in the Soviet Union. It's first as an English interpreter for Andrei Sakharov, and then becoming a leader, a dissident in his own right. He was involved in that activity for a number of years. He was convicted in 1978 of treason and was imprisoned. And finally, in 1986, he was released as part of an East-West prisoner exchange and then moved to Israel and has lived there ever since. He's the author of a new book that is getting some attention here in the United States titled The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. The book is published by Public Affairs and makes the basic argument that peace in the Middle East, particularly the solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, depends, that is, the solution depends on democratization. The book is out now in the bookstores. He's spending some time here in the United States talking about it. He met last week President Bush, who read the book and had some good things to say about it. So he's in Chicago today and is good enough to spend some time with us talking on the telephone. Also along with him is his co-author on this book. His name is Ron Dermer. He holds degrees from University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business and from Oxford. He's worked in Israel as a political consultant for the last 8 years. He is a former columnist for the Jerusalem Post and now makes his home in Jerusalem. As we talk with our guests, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief in their comments so that we can accommodate as many different people as possible and try and keep the program moving. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Sharansky, hello.
Yes.
And Mr. Dermer.
Hi.
Thanks, both of you, for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I wonder, maybe I would ask Mr. Sharansky if you could summarize for us the essential argument that you're making in the case for democracy and specifically how that applies to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Look, everybody understands that the weapons of massive destruction in the hands of terrorists are very dangerous. But very few understand that the weapon of mass construction, meaning the weapon of freedom and democracy, in the hands of the free world can change the world. And today we hear the same questions, the same doubts as a dissident heard in the Soviet Union 30 years ago. We hear, but if freedom is for everybody, if freedom somewhere is good for our stability, isn't it better for us to have some reliable dictators? And the third, even if it is for everybody, and even if it gives us more stability and security, is there a role for the free world? Can really free world impose or encourage democracy anywhere? And we explain why freedom is for everybody, why freedom is very good for security, and even the most friendly dictator is very dangerous for peace in this world, and why the free world can play a tremendous role, as it was in the case of winning the Cold War, to promote democracy without even one shot. And when the linkage between security and democracy is taking place, as it was in the case of the Soviet Union, the world can be very successful in defeating tyranny and bringing freedom. When this linkage is violated, as in the case of peace process in the Middle East, when all the peace process was built on the illusion that strong dictator can take care of the terrorists, then the results are very bad. That's more or less what this book is about.
Hmm. You, as I understand, met with the president last week, and he, the stories that I have read say that the president has read a good portion of your book and supports the ideas, and I think that you have been supportive of for the most part American policy in the Middle East, specifically in Iraq. You were quoted as saying to the president, "Very few people in the world believe like you do in the ideal of democracy for all people. You are going against the flow. You are the world's dissident." Assuming that that's an accurate quote.
The quote is absolutely correct. Though all the conversation was off the record, but what I said, I permitted myself to quote, and that's absolutely true. I have to say I was very impressed. First of all, you have to understand, we wrote this book hoping that people who are influencing the policy will read it. And we hope that step by step, we'll start from the grassroots, and at some moment we will reach to the leaders who are responsible for politics. Because, of course, we didn't expect that among the first Americans who will read this book will be President of the United States of America. And when we received the call on the third day of our book tour, we received a call from White House that President Bush wants to discuss this book. And hour after this, we received calls that Condoleezza Rice wants to discuss with us book. It was very impressive. When we came first to Condoleezza Rice, and I brought this book with the inscription, she already read this book. She was on page 100 approximately. And she said, "You know why I am reading this book?" So I thought that she wants to say, because it's such a good book. But she said, "I am reading this book because President is reading, and I should better know what he is reading." And then when we came, and it was a very good conversation with her, and then we came to President some hours later, and he was on page 210. From 286 pages, and it was very impressive how deeply he adopted or supports, sympathizes to these ideas. And I think the reason why he wanted to meet, because he found out that those very important things which he's saying for 2 years at least, there can be serious theoretical background when you study it from inside of totalitarian regime and not from the top of the free world. You can understand how mechanism of tyranny works and why it is right approach to when you look for stability and democracy, to start from democracy, and then you'll get also stability. Mm.
Both President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have said that they think that Middle East peace is very important, perhaps one of the most important things on their agenda, at least when it comes to foreign policy. In what ways do you think the United States and perhaps also Britain can be constructively involved in this process?
Yeah, if I could interject.
Sure.
I think the important thing to realize in terms of thinking about what role the free world can play to move this process in the right direction is the argument of the book is essentially this, that what U.S. policy should be and what the policy of the entire free world, frankly, should be, is that those leaders among the Palestinians who are willing to embrace reform should be embraced. Though, and what does that mean by embracing reform? It means not focusing necessarily on how this Palestinian leader thinks, what he thinks about Israel. The question that we are much more interested in is how he thinks about his own people. Is he giving rights to his own people? Is there dissent in his society? Is he taking Palestinians who for four generations have lived in refugee camps? Does he want to take them out of those camps? Is he educating them and giving them a real education or just educating them for hate? Is he trying to improve their lives with job opportunities? All of these questions, where in previous years were basically abandoned, and what they said was, let's make Arafat as strong as possible. We don't really care what he does in areas under his control. The only thing that's important is that Arafat fight the quote-unquote extremists and Hamas and the other terror groups. And this approach of saying that peace will be built with a dictator has been seen to be a complete failure. And the approach has to be the opposite. Now, the leaders of the free world can play a critical role, particularly with the Palestinians, because Palestinian society is entirely dependent on the free world. They're entirely dependent for their money. They're entirely dependent for international aid, for territorial concessions, for jobs, for everything they're entirely dependent. And so if we have a very clear message, you want to give rights to your own people, you want to embrace real democratic reform, we'll embrace you. If you don't, then we won't give you any legitimacy, we won't give you concessions, and we won't give you support. And very quickly, this process will be moving in the right direction.
For the big question that everyone has been discussing now since Yasser Arafat died was how that changes things. And before, many people in the government of Israel, certainly Mr. Sharon, said that they felt that Yasser Arafat was an impediment to peace. Now that he is gone, the big question is, will it have some sort of positive effect? Will it make it possible for the representatives of the Palestinians and the government of Israel to actually sit down and start talking again? Do you think, Mr. Sharansky, that that's likely to happen?
First of all, no doubt that Yasser Arafat was a very serious obstacle for peace. And by the way, we have to salute to President Bush, who really made the best effort to marginalize him and to weaken his influence, Yasser Arafat's influence, negative influence on the developments in the Middle East. But today, in fact, there is new opportunity. If President Bush, 2 years ago in his historical speech in June 2002, was speaking about need of change in the leadership, today this change is happening because of the objective reasons. But whether these new opportunities will be used or not depends mainly on us. Whether we will be looking now in a hurry for a new strong leader who can bring stability to the Middle East, then definitely it means that we repeat the mistakes of the past. And suffering of Palestinians will continue, and there will be no peace. Or the new leadership will be ready to take Palestinians out of refugee camps, to change the system of education from hatred to good education for Palestinians, to work together with us on the free world on creating jobs for Palestinians, to permit dissent and to fight terror. And then it should be strengthened.
And if I could just add to that very quickly, I think based on your question about are we going to be able to have meetings and talks and can we sit down at the table, I think one of the illusions that we're trying to argue against in this book is that simply by talking you get somewhere. The idea that that a democratic state will meet with a dictator and they'll have conferences and they'll have summits and they'll have all this goodwill between the parties, that this will lead to any result, this is what we fundamentally reject. And I think that was shown during the Cold War, particularly the end of the Cold War, where on the one hand you had people, those who were advocating a policy of détente, and they said, look, we have this Soviet Union. We're not going to be able to change the nature of this society from within. The best thing that we can do is try to reach some sort of accommodation with it. Let's talk with them. Let's have a lot of goodwill. Let's start all of this warmongering that they accused President Reagan of the time of leading this policy of warmongering. Let's just sit down and talk around a table and we'll solve the problems. And then there was another approach, and it said we don't really are not interested in having summits and conferences with Soviet leaders. We're not interested in what the Soviet leaders are saying about us. What we're interested in is whether the Soviet leaders are giving their own people's rights. Are they giving human rights to their own people? Because if they are, that is the type of society with which we could live in peace. And it's the same thing here. If we focus on who the leaders are and rushing to sit down at a table with them and to talk to them and say, here's a guy who's a moderate, here's a guy who wears a suit, here's a guy who speaks good English, then we're going to fail again. But if we focus on what this person is doing for his own people, is he interested in improving Palestinian lives? If he's interested in improving Palestinian lives, if he is dependent on the Palestinians for his power, meaning if he's a democratic and accountable leader, then eventually you will get a compromise no matter what, because the case that we make in this book, the case for democracy, is that democratic states don't go to war because leaders are dependent on people who always see war as a last resort.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, either of you, but do I hear you saying that you believe that Yasser Arafat was a dictator?
He was a corrupt dictator. And I have to say that some years ago, I had many debates in my own government when everybody was agreeing that he's a corrupt dictator, but some of our my colleagues were saying it's very bad to say it, because he is the hero of Palestinian people, and you are insulting them. Why do you create these problems? And I was saying again and again that Arafat is hero of his people, exactly as Stalin was the hero of his people. In the era after Stalin, very quickly, you could find out what people feel and what they think when they are not dependent anymore on this dictator. And I think the same will will happen now.
Look, I know that for some of your listeners it may be very difficult to imagine that you can actually create some sort of free society among the Palestinians, because they'll see day after day on their television screens the pictures of thousands of people chanting in the streets, and a bus will be blown up and people will be dancing as they danced in Palestinian cities after 9/11. So they say, what are you talking about, democracy with these people? They have a completely different culture, completely different values and everything else. But you have to understand, and this is what I've tried to understand, somebody who didn't grow up in a fear society like Nathan did. I grew up in the United States. But what I've tried to understand over the last few years in working and listening to Nathan is how these societies work. If you are a Palestinian, it's important for, I think, your listeners to understand that the regime that governs the Palestinians, that rules with a lot of repression, that rules the Palestinian, they control all the jobs, they control all the aid, they have a monopoly on all the goods, so that if you're a Palestinian and you want to survive in that society, you have to demonstrate loyalty to this regime. Now, we from the free world, we look at these societies from the outside and we say, look, they're just a bunch of fanatics running around. But the fact is that we, in the argument that we're making in this book, is that people will not choose to live in fear. They will choose freedom. And when you have leaders that are interested in improving lives, not because they're good leaders, not because a leader tells you he's interested in improving their lives, simply because he's accountable. One of the arguments that we make in the book is, you know, what's the difference between a democratic leader and a dictator? Both democratic leaders and dictators want to stay in power. But you know the difference is that a democrat, in order to stay in power, has to keep people happy. A dictator, to stay in power, has to keep people under control. And that is the fundamental difference. And if we push the region much more in that direction and focusing on accountable leaders and democratic changes, then you're going to see this whole region move towards a much more peaceful and stable situation than it is now.
Well, let me perhaps ask one more question, and then I have a caller I want to get to. Given the fact that some Palestinians, at least, would have said that Yasser Arafat had been their choice, their democratically elected choice as leader, what sort of election would be the qualities of an election that then the government of Israel and the people of Israel would accept to produce a new leader?
Well, let me say quickly about Yasser Arafat's election. You know, I've been involved in a lot of campaigns and election, and I would love to run a campaign for a politician who has absolutely no opponents, who has total control of the media, and then who kneecaps anybody who dares criticize him. So to argue that this is some sort of freely elected leader, Arafat, and is the choice of his people, I just don't think is borne out by the facts. He was a dictator who was brought in from Tunis and imposed on the Palestinians, and then there was some sort of snap farce election. But I think a wider point is this. Elections are not the beginning of a democratic process. Elections are, well, if not the end of it, well towards the end of it. What we're looking for here and what we argue for in the book, how do we define a free society? A free society is a society that has to pass what we call the town square test, meaning you can go in the middle of the town square and you could say what you want without fear of arrest, imprisonment, or physical harm. That was never the case under Yasser Arafat. Never the case under Yasser Arafat. When you have an election in such a society where you can actually go to the town square and you can dissent, then you have a free election. Until you can do that, you won't have a free election. That's it. Whatever process right now that the Palestinians will choose their leader, it doesn't make a difference. That is certainly not going to be a democratically elected leader, but it'll be some leader with some sort of legitimacy. The question is, how does the free world then behave? The free world then has to demand of that leader, we want you to have certain reforms. And if you don't have reforms, we're just not going to deal with you. You can continue to stay and to repressively rule your people, but you're not going to be invited to the White House. We're not going to be showering you with millions and millions and billions, actually, dollars in aid. We're just going to cut you off. That is, I think, what the message the free world has to send. And then you can move this process along the path towards democracy, which wants to take many years, but at least we can start it.
Hmm. And Mr. Sharansky, anything you'd want to add to that?
No, I think that is very important to remember that Soviet Union had elections through all their years, always in time, always 99% voted for, and there was never a democratic leader. Saddam Hussein was elected regularly in elections. So elections by themselves, it's not democracy. And it doesn't matter by what method you organize these elections. Or people are living in free society and elect freely, or they live in fear society, then it doesn't matter what kind of elections are. That's why in 2 months, Palestinians are going under the law to have elections. We have to understand it's technical process how this leader will be chosen. There will be one candidate. They'll decide in advance the leaders who will be this candidate. he'll be elected. Important thing begins after this. After this, there must be serious reforms, which with the time really will bring to free elections in free society. And that should be our aim.
Let me introduce again our guests. We're almost at our midpoint here, and then I have a caller we're going to get to. Natan Sharansky is a former Soviet dissident and political prisoner who is now and has for a number of years now been living in Israel and has become an important player in the politics of Israel. For the past 9 years, he served in different Israeli governments, holding various positions, including deputy prime minister. Currently, he is the minister for Jerusalem and diaspora affairs. He's the author of a memoir about his experiences in the Soviet Union titled Fear No Evil, and also the co-author of a new book here that's titled The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. It's published by Public Affairs. He is spending some time in the United States talking about the book, along with his co-author, who is also our guest this morning, Ron Dermer. He's worked in Israel as a political consultant for the past 8 years. He's also former columnist for the Jerusalem Post newspaper. And they're both joining us by telephone from Chicago. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here with us in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. It's hard to know where to begin, but I think I'll focus on what I was planning on calling about, which is I don't know if a close reading at the White House would have asked this question, but I have this question of you, which is, if you're talking about a real democracy, one cannot have a particular confessional group or a ethnic group any kind of particular privilege in that democracy. I don't know whether that goes down well in our current White House, but there has to be some kind of secularity, and it just seems to me that you would probably oppose an Islamic Republic in Palestine. Why should anyone accept that there shouldn't be a separation of quote church and state, whatever you want to call it, in Israel and anywhere else in the world? Isn't this a basic premise of democracy? And do you spend any time talking about that?
Yeah, we do actually discuss that question somewhere in the book. And to tell you the truth, you wouldn't have a problem with a society where the people who are very committed to their religion would be those that would be freely elected. I mean, if you have a situation where you're living in a free society, where people have a right to dissent, where there is the exchange of ideas, and let's say you have a situation where people have decided through free elections to elect what most people in the West would call fundamentalist leaders, then what do you do? And I think the real question is, what does the free world do after that? If that society will then continue to hold elections, will continue to be a free society, will continue to protect the right of dissent, then I think that that's the choice that that society made, and you have to respect that choice. But if they repress dissent afterwards, if it's one man, one vote, one time, then the free world has to take a very clear stand. There are a lot of people who say, look, you know, you talk about democracy, but can't democracy bring to power very unpalatable leaders? Take 1933 in Germany, where Nazis were elected in democratic elections. They got a plurality of the vote. But we have to ask ourselves, was the danger of Nazi Germany the fact that the Nazis were democratically elected, or the fact when the Nazis decided to suspend democracy within Germany, the free world did not respond? That's really the question. The same thing with Iran. It can be argued that Iran in 1979, that these people represented at the beginning the will of the public. But very quickly it became clear that this was a repressive and totalitarian regime that did not allow free dissent within their societies, and the world did not hold them accountable.
Well,
that's
there are
much
say.
More complicated.
Yes,
story.
There can be Islamic democratic country. There can be Christian democratic country. There can be Jewish democratic country. And there can be secular democratic country, because whether it is democratic or not is defined by one thing, whether dissent is permitted or dissent is punished. And majority of people have the right to decide what kind of democratic country it will be.
Well, it's a very... I don't accept that, actually. I think that democracy means rule of the people, and it shouldn't allow any particular privilege for any particular ideology, point of view, or religion.
Privileges.
So I disagree fundamentally.
The rights of minorities are defended by the fact that that there is a right for dissent. As they're wrong, there is no right for dissent. The rights of minorities are protected.
Well, the right to say that they don't like the situation is protected, but the right to do anything about it is probably not.
Well, that's
as
right.
was illustrated
election,
quite
they
wild,
have a right
widely.
To do something about it.
Excuse me?
If they have elections, if you have free elections, let's say for argument's sake you have a fundamentalist regime that takes over, but that the free world insists that the right of dissent is protected. And let's say the people don't like it. Well, then the people will throw them out. The problem is that there's almost never been a time where fundamentalists have actually been chosen. And once they get into power from some means or another, they always repress democracy. They always suspend democracy because they know when people are given a free choice, they're not going to choose to live in fear. That's very clear. And so that, I think, is what the position of the free world has to be all the time, to insist that every country respects the right of dissent within.
America is an ideal model of democracy, but it's not the only type of democracy which exists today in this world.
Well, it's a lot more complicated than what we're getting at. In Iran, there was quite a widespread variety of sources, and actually it was the isolation by the West that undermined such as Bani Sadr, who were the secular types in it, and we sort of got what we asked for, which is sort of like when Israel was funding Hamas as a counterbalance to the secular PLO.
I would say that all the peace process was built on this, that secular dictator Arafat has to destroy religious dictators Hamas, and we see what came out of this. As long as we will be trying to use one dictator against the other to guarantee our security, that's what we will get.
Well, that's what Israel did when it was funding Hamas. But I'll let someone else have a chance. But as far as the corruption, both Sharon and Netanyahu have escaped, but are really fundamentally corrupt. Have corrupt business practices. It's ridiculous for people to be holier than thou and to point their fingers.
That's really ridiculous. That's exactly what we mean in our book when we are speaking about moral clarity. Of course, in every free society, there can be problems. It cannot be absolutely just society. You had your Watergate. You had awful scandals in comparison with which what you just now mentioned about Netanyahu and Sharon is only ridiculous. But the power of democracy is that all these scandals will be brought to light and you have institutions to fight there. Here you are having a society where a dictator simply decides that he takes 20% of public money and puts it on his private account, and now all the world is surprised from where are these billions of Yasser Arafat. If only 100 shekels were taken in such a way by Netanyahu, Sharon, or anybody, they will be already in prison.
And I just want to add one thing that I think is very important in this point about moral clarity. If the Israeli people find their leaders to be corrupt, they can throw them out of office. If the Palestinian leaders find their people to be corrupt, they still have to be stuck with them and to be repressed by them. So to compare one thing and the other is, to me, absolutely an absurdity. That is for the American people to decide when they have their leaders how to judge them. It's for the Israeli people to decide, and I very much wish that the Palestinian people all these years had a right to decide, because I can assure you Yasser Arafat would have been thrown out of office a long time ago.
Let me ask, I'm interested in asking Mr. Sharansky, and of course, Mr. Dermer, you could get in on this question too. Let us assume that elections are held and you get a new Palestinian leadership that you feel the government of Israel can work with. What do you think that there is anything that the government of Israel could do or should do to try to support that new Palestinian leadership?
Of course, as I said, and it was written in my plan, which I proposed to Prime Minister 2 years ago, that if there is agreement that this leadership starts dismantling refugee camps and stop keeping fourth generation of Palestinians in these refugee camps, we should mobilize all our resources from Israel and from all the free world to help them in this. If they want to create real joint ventures for the businesses. As by the way, we were trying to propose, but Yasser Arafat didn't want to lose control over his people. We should use all our resources, and the free world should use all the resources to help them in this. If they want to stop this awful education for hatred and to give decent modern education to Palestinians, I think there are big opportunities where we can cooperate, by the way, also with Palestinians of diaspora who are highly educated. And so on and so on. And as I wrote in the platform of my party when we were creating this party, the depth of our concessions, including all types of concessions, should be at the depth of democratic process on the other side.
Do you still remain opposed to Mr. Sharon's plan to withdraw Jewish settlers from Gaza?
Yeah, I voted against, and I want to remind you why I voted against. I said, not because we have to stay in Gaza. I believe that our concessions for peace will be much bigger than only leaving Gaza, leaving many other places. But when you are giving one-sided concessions to the terrorists, it only means that terror strengthens. If we leave today, Gaza we left already many years ago, but Gush Katif will become part of the battleground for the terrorist state, exactly as all those cities which we left became the center of terrorist activity. That's why, yes, we have to make these concessions, but only as a part of the process of democratization, of building civil society.
Some people apparently have called for a popular referendum on this, and Mr. Sharon says that he opposes that. Do you think that it's likely that that will happen? That there would be a referendum, or he does have the votes, does he not, to go ahead and do it?
First of all, democratically, Ariel Sharon can do now disengagement without asking for popular vote, because it was governed, it passed Knesset, that's it. And we are a very strong democracy in the most difficult, in the middle of the war, we never postponed our elections even for 1 month. So democratically he can do it. But it is such a difficult decision, such a painful decision for many people, that I, as many others, feel that the same decision will be much easier to fulfill, to make, to implement, if it will pass also the test of the public vote. And I, by the way, I believe that Ariel Sharon can get this support. But again, today, when the situation is quickly changing, and when there probably will be, not probably, now it's clear that there will be new leadership, I think the important thing is to find a way to connect all our concessions with the possible changes, democratic changes, on the Palestinian side.
Let's talk with someone else in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mr. Inge, I do want to thank you, and I mean this seriously, for bringing us the sort of alternative Orwellian universe of Zionist propaganda. I think it is something that people should hear and that people should understand, that this is the world, the universe, the sort of alternative universe that many people who are just, operate within Jewish institutions, this is what they hear every day from the literature they receive, the meetings they go to at Jewish Federation and various temples and synagogues. So, I mean, this is the world that is being defined, in line with the mainstream media. But even when you listen to the mainstream media, I don't think you get anything quite this blatant. And it is important for your listeners to be exposed to alternative points of view. But if I may just take a slight detour into the real world here, there is a military dictatorship in the occupied territories. It's been imposed on the Palestinian people for the last 37 years by Israel. And there is no way in which the government of Israel wants a democratic government in Palestine. They have rejected it with U.S. support again and again, over and over again. And it's just, the real world will tell us, in history, will tell us something very, very different from what these two men are saying about the military occupation, the control over people's movement, the strangulation of the economy, the settler violence, the bypass roads, Jewish-only settlements. And since when does a democratic society have something called Jewish-only settlements, Jewish-only roads? Since when does a democratic society threaten a Israeli citizen, Palestinian legislator who advocates for something other than a Jewish state, threatens him with being disbarred from his member in the Israeli parliament? Since when does a democratic government in 1982 attempt to, by force, impose a non-democratic government upon Lebanon and in the process kill 20,000 people? So, there is much to be said here, but just to say that, we're entering an alternative reality here. I understand that as a host you have to take it seriously. I recommend that people look elsewhere to and not be shy about seeing this propaganda exactly for what it is.
Well, if I could just respond to the rantings of your last guest. First of all, let me just say that as to say this is what you hear in Federation all the time, day after day, I would recommend that all your readers look at exactly what Israel's been saying for many, many years, because, frankly, one of the reasons why we wrote this...
Israel has rejected
the process. If I could just finish, sir, I'd really interrupt you. I found many of the things that you said to be offensive.
So
if you could just let me respond, and just to give me the same respect that I gave you, because you made a lot of charges against Israel, and I'd like to respond to them. First thing, let me say that the ideas that Natan has been championing, he's been championing for 30 years. He did it from the Gulag. He didn't do it from the free world, and he's also doing it from the Israeli cabinet table. These are ideas, the idea that you have to link the peace process to democratic reforms that very few Israeli leaders, either on the left or the right, have actually supported. So it has nothing, I don't know, with the rantings of Zionist propaganda and everything else that you're saying, it has nothing to do with it. This is a different idea. One of the reasons why we wrote this book and why we were hoping that it would somehow influence American policy is precisely because it has not been the policy of the government of Israel or the government of the United States for many years. As to the idea of imposing a military occupation, it might be good for you to understand what happened in 1967. In 1967, the state of Israel, that at the time, and your listeners should understand this, did not control the West Bank, did not control the Gaza Strip, did not control the Golan Heights. It was a very small state that was 9 miles wide. Now, there are roads not only in Texas, but in most cities, probably in Indiana and probably in Illinois, that are longer than Israel was wide. It was attacked by an aggressive war of Arab countries, and Israel defended itself. In the course of this war of self-defense, that the whole international community said was a war of self-defense, Israel took control of these territories. And the UN, the international community, passed resolutions saying that only when the Arab states are willing to make peace with Israel, should Israel return these territories. It was territories in return for peace. Not territories in return for terror, but territories in return for peace. And the Democratic State of Israel, by the way, when it controlled these places in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, gave the Palestinians the right to dissent. It was very different than what the rights that they were used to. You should understand, and your listeners should understand, that the only place in the Middle East today where an Arab can say what he wants, when he wants, where he wants, is within the state of Israel. The example that you gave of a lawyer being disbarred and not being in the parliament is absolutely ridiculous. That was a member of parliament, of the Israeli parliament, that went and met with an enemy. It met with Hezbollah in Syria, and there was a debate within the Israeli government whether or not this person in the Israeli parliament, whether this person should be prevented from running in the Knesset. And the Supreme Court of the State of Israel, a court that defends rights, that no Arab state, to the best of my knowledge, actually has a court that defends the rights of its own citizens, the Supreme Court ruled that this person who had met with an enemy in the time of war should be allowed to run. So I don't know all these rantings and who is living in the Orwellian world, but I think it's very important to understand the facts and to not just simply try to sell propaganda to listeners.
And one more remark. There it was said, where can you see purely Jewish settlements and not Arab settlements? I want to remind you that in Israel, 20% of the population are Arabs, who live in their own villages and together with Jews, who live in their own towns and together with the Jews, who are citizens with all the rights and who are represented in Knesset and who have the right to dissent and everything else. And nobody would ever think in democratic Israel that these citizens should be removed. Now, at the same time, every piece of territory which goes under the control of Palestinian Authority, it goes without saying, all the world expects that all the Jews will be evacuated. And why? Because it's clear that they will be simply killed if they will not be evacuated. So if there is created to a territory which is free from Jews, it's territory which is under control of Palestinian Authority, and it is accepted by the world. If there is territory where Jews and Arabs live as equal citizens, that is the territory of the State of Israel.
Yeah, and also just the final point, it should be aware that, you know, in Saudi Arabia, a Jew cannot come and put his foot in Saudi Arabia. It's against the law. And in Jordan, a Jew cannot buy land. So there is no laws like that within the State of Israel that prevents the Arabs from living there. As Natan said, 20% of our citizens live there. They have the right to vote. They have elected leaders. A Jew cannot
buy land in many Arab countries. And to make this sort of comparison between how Jews on the one hand are treated within Palestinian society is not unexplained. It goes without saying that the world thinks that all of a sudden no Jew is allowed to live in a future Palestinian state. But of course, Israel would have to give full rights, which they do, to 20%, the 20% of their population that is Muslim. So I think you got to get your facts straight.
I'm going to jump in here. We have about 7-8 minutes left. I have another caller. I feel I should introduce again our guests. So we're talking this morning with Natan Sharansky and Ron Dermer. Natan Sharansky is a former Soviet dissident and political prisoner and now important player in Israeli politics. Currently, he is Minister for Jerusalem and Diaspora Affairs. He has held a number of other posts in various Israeli governments, including serving as Minister of Industry and Trade, as Minister of the Interior, as Minister of Housing and Construction, and also Deputy Prime Minister. Ron Dermer has worked in Israel as a political consultant for the last 8 years. He's a former columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Together, they're authors of a book titled The Case for Democracy, The Power of Freedom to Overcome Tyranny and Terror. It's published by Public Affairs. They're spending some time in the United States talking about the book. They're in Chicago today. We have another caller here in a nearby community of Belgium near Danville on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. I have a question in that I wonder what kind of combinations of cultures and societies get together to form the situations you have that create young women who will strap a bomb on their body and go kill other people. This is something totally abhorrent to everybody. There has to be two sides to this that have caused this. It's not just the Palestinians that make these bombers. It takes the conflict with Israel to make these bombers also.
Well, let me answer on your question. I remember there was one woman some months ago, Palestinian, who put a belt with explosives on her leg, in fact, and came and exploded, killed herself, and killed four Israelis. And the Western press was writing, how cruel is Israeli occupation if this woman is ready to leave her two children, 3 years old and 1 year old, and to become a suicide bomber? And the truth is very simple. This woman was sentenced to honored killing for, as they said, was unfaithful to her husband. Honored killing is something regular, normal in Palestinian society, unfortunately, under this dictatorship. And then she was given a choice. Or she will be killed by honored killing, or, and there was a special fatwa, that she can be permitted to become a suicide bomber. And this woman was sentenced by this society, by these groups, to kill herself, to leave her two children, and to kill Jews. And yes, what kind of society can permit honored killings? What kind of society can treat sexual minorities in the way in which Palestinian society they are treated, when the only way for homosexual to be saved in Ramallah is to ask for political asylum in Jerusalem, and so on and so on? It is very important to understand that only free society, which respects human rights, can guarantee real peace and stability. And that's exactly society which we want for Palestinians. Yes, we want that Palestinian leadership itself will create a society where the rights of women will be respected and there will be no honored killings, that the rights of every person will be respected, and such type of society will live in peace with us.
Okay, and if I could just also add to that, because I think that the caller brings up a very important point, and it's something that I think is widely believed, and that is that the root cause of terrorism against Israel is the Israeli occupation, and that in Israel and somehow is just as responsible, if not more responsible, for bringing the Palestinians to do these what are commonly referred to as desperate acts. I think it's very important, at least for the listeners, to open their minds for a second and try to understand what the root cause of terrorism is. And when I say terrorism, anyone can call anyone a terrorist. So we have to have what a definition. What is terrorism? Terrorism is the deliberate, systematic attack against civilians. That is how I'm defining terrorism. And then we have to ask ourselves, what is the root cause of terrorism? Is it occupation? Well, if the root cause of terrorism were occupation, then we could take the worst occupation in the history of the world, and that was the occupation by the Nazis of Europe. I think most people would agree to it. The French resistance did not kill the wives and children of German officers. They did not blow up buses.
They did not go into cafes and kill people because the French resistance were Democrats. They were not terrorists. The idea that there is somehow a grievance that justifies terrorism, and if you redress the grievance, then you'll get to the root cause of terrorism, is fundamentally misguided. Gandhi had a legitimate national grievance, but Gandhi did not resort to terrorism. Martin Luther King had a legitimate grievance, but he did not resort to terrorism. So then you have to ask yourself, why is it that leaders like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and, frankly, the Jewish underground that were fighting under very difficult conditions under the British, and again, the Jewish underground almost never attacked civilians. They attacked military installations of the British in pre-1948 Israel, but they almost never attacked civilians. Why is it that all of these people, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the French resistance, why is it that they did not resort to terrorism if the root cause of terrorism is an occupation or a grievance? And the answer is that the root cause of terrorism is a totalitarian mindset. And that is the result of systematic brainwashing of people that happens within fear societies and under totalitarian regimes that can create people that can believe that there is some goal that is so all-encompassing that it justifies anything. That is the root cause of terrorism. That is why every single totalitarian regime in human history has been wedded to terrorism. And we have to get rid of this nonsensical idea that occupation has somehow driven the Palestinians to commit terrorist acts. There is a legitimate way for Palestinians to redress their grievances. It belongs at a negotiating table. It is meeting with Israel, is giving rights to their own people and engaging in a peace process, and then they will find a ready and willing Israeli society. Every time Israel has faced an Arab leader who wanted to make peace and who talked peace to his own people, they made peace, whether it was Anwar Sadat or whether it was King Hussein. If the Palestinians have a leadership that is dependent on them, that cares about improving their lives, Israel and Palestinians will make peace.
Would you accept the notion that by this point that both sides in this conflict have demonized the other to the point where they see them as less than human, and that's an obstacle to people getting together and talking?
Yeah, no, I fundamentally don't accept that. And here is the difference again. Let us look at what the state is doing in these societies. Do I think that there are individuals within Israeli society who have demonized Palestinians? Absolutely. The question is, what is the state, what is the government, what is the media doing? That is the issue. The Palestinian Authority under Yasser Arafat controlled every word that was published in its press, that aired on its television. And it was incitement the likes of which Israel has never seen. In fact, the generation of Palestinians that grew up under Yasser Arafat hate Israel far more than the generation that grew up before. And frankly, Israel was giving concessions. Israel had given back territory. So if the idea is if Israel would just end the occupation, you'd end this incitement and end this hatred, it's just fundamentally not true. The more Israel made concessions to this, the more there was hatred on the Palestinian side. On the Israeli side, you do not have in any way incitement from the government or from the media. And you can't compare an individual, quote-unquote extremist individuals within Israeli society, of which there are a few, like there are in any society, with the systematic state support for incitement and hatred.
I want to say that there is flood of traditional anti-Semitism, really flood of traditional anti-Semitism, which comes today from Palestinian Authority, from Egypt, and from Syria. And you can see how Jewish rabbis are cutting the throats of Christian boys and making from their blood matzah, how Jews are poisoning the wells, how Jews are controlling the world. I never saw anything like this said by Jewish media or Jewish state about Arabs and Palestinians. And in fact, all our book is not only about love to our state. It's also about deep respect and love to Palestinians, whom we want to see living in the same, with the same destiny, with the same dignity, with the same sense of freedom as we live. And that is the difference.
We're almost out of time. I want to try to very quickly accommodate maybe one more caller, at least very briefly. Urbana here, line one. Hello.
Yes. There was an article recently by Bernard Lewis who posed this question. When the Palestinians talk about ending the occupation, do they mean a one-state solution, which includes Palestine as one state, a Palestinian state, or do they mean a two-state solution? What is your view of that?
Well, I would say, first of all, that when you started the question by saying when the Palestinians talk, I wish that the Palestinians could talk. Because the only people who we've heard from is the Palestinian leadership that is an unelected, unaccountable dictatorship. It's like saying what the Chinese want. How do we know what the Chinese want?
Yeah, but the media says...
Okay, so the media. Of course, there are going to be certain people that are going to say one thing or the other. I think there's no question that this idea of destroying the Jewish state, the idea that that the peace process was some sort of Trojan horse to destroy the Jewish state in the end, is very prevalent today and is ascended within Palestinian society. You have a society that has been poisoned because of the systematic state-supported incitement. Very much like Nazi Germany in 1933, you take Germany in the 20s and the early 30s, and then you take Germany in the 30s and the early 40s, and it's like two completely different societies. And right afterwards, by 1950, by 1955, you also had a new Germany and a different Germany because of the fact that you ended this state support for incitement. Right now, I think that the PLO has always been dedicated to the idea of destroying the state of Israel. It was founded in 1964. I want to repeat that date, 1964, which is 3 years before 1967, at a time when Israel did not control the West Bank and did not control Gaza Strip. And they said, we want to liberate Palestine. Well, what was Palestine at that time? Palestine at that time was the pre-1967 state of Israel. So it's very important to understand the facts and understand that the PLO has always been dedicated to destroying Israel. We hope very much that a Palestinian leadership that is dedicated to improving the lives of their own people will, by necessity, because they want to improve the lives of their own people, try to forge a compromise with the state of Israel so both peoples can live in peace.
Let me add one more thing, that it's very easy, really easy and simple, to accuse Palestinian leadership, to accuse dictators in the Middle East in the suffering of their own people. But in our book, we are accusing also the leadership of the free world, our leadership, the fact that they were trying to appease these dictatorships instead of being concerned about free and good life for all the people in this world. And what we are saying in our book, that all, not only all the people are equal, all the peoples are equal, they all deserve to live in freedom, that freedom of people is good for our stability and security, and that it is in the hands of the free world to encourage, to strengthen freedom and democracy all over.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're at the end of our time. I want to thank you both. Natan Sharansky, thank you, Mr. Sharansky, for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And Ron Dermer, thank you.
Thank you for having us.